This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Focus on our collective past, but a look at the present and a glimpse of the future. Along the way, we'll stimulate interest in reading and affirm our longtime commitment to the arts. Get in touch about a piece you think should be included to express your interest in reading a particular piece or just to read. Deadline is December 21st. Visit kpft.org for details. Again, visit our website at kpft.org. KPFT, Houston.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for people.
FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
Brian Lubinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on this evening's program, we will have Nancy Ford talking about Julie Garland Christmas special, a return to 1963 when CBS first aired this sort of ultra-campy black-and-white television special. We have special programming from This Way Out. The News Wrap guys had the turkey weekend off, so we're going to wrap them into our show with a couple of special programs, and one of those is about an anniversary at the church in Los Angeles. The Metropolitan Community Church out there recently celebrated a significant milestone. And then in the second hour, we have Harvey Milk interviews, roundtable interviews with Gus Van Sant, Justin Lance Black, Josh Brolin, and James Franco, and that will last for the second hour. However, to start things off this evening, it is World AIDS Day, and we have a couple of folks in the studio. We have Falcon and Sally Huffer.
Welcome to the studio, Sally and Falcon.
Welcome, both of you.
I just want to reiterate, it's not Falcon and Sally Huffer, because Falcon's last name is not Huffer.
I was wondering about that. Huffer. Was there something you need to tell us?
We got married.
In California, it's a marriage.
Was it a same-sex marriage?
Y'all could get married in Texas.
No, it's a marriage of convenience, so we can have babies, so we can adopt.
I see.
We're trying to get that all changed.
Closeted heterosexual, huh?
Ixnay.
Yeah.
Hey, it's World's AIDS Day. This Saturday is an event down at the Hobby Center. Tell us about it.
Well, let's talk about World AIDS Day today. Oh. I mean, there was a lot of things that went on. Today is World AIDS Day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yes.
So I know that we just got back from the Candlelight Vigil downtown.
I know. It's the 20th anniversary of World AIDS Day.
And Mayor White was there, gave a great speech.
And City Council Member Peter Brown and City Council Member Wanda Adams.
And Sally was there.
Sally who?
Sally Huffer.
Oh, Sally Huffer.
Yeah. And Falcon.
And Falcon Huffer.
And earlier today, I went to the World AIDS Day luncheon at the Corinthian.
How was that?
It was very nice. You know, the Corinthian is like this old bank that they converted into an event space, and it's very elaborate and very, very nice.
Yeah, Jackson Hicks, I think.
Yeah, he catered it and everything.
Lovely.
That's good.
It's funny because we saw Brian earlier, And he was all dressed up wearing a jacket and a tie.
He was pretty.
And he had his red ribbon on.
And I still do.
Well, you don't have the jacket and the tie.
No, I wore that for the luncheon. So.
He's in plain clothes now.
But he still has his ribbon, and I'm really impressed by that.
Yes, it's hard to find these ribbons. I think last year we kind of stocked the city with a lot of ribbons with our efforts with World AIDS Day.
We sure did.
But anyway, today's World AIDS Day, but we have another event to look forward to next weekend.
Right. And before he gets a chance to talk about it.
Because this has been his whole life.
I'm her husband, so she's going to shut me up already.
No, I'm just going to say, he's done such a yeoman's work. If we were really married, I probably wouldn't be, you know, speaking your graces.
Because of his name.
There you go.
No, truly, he's done a yeoman's job in putting this together. I mean, from, you know, early summer that we started talking about it?
July, yeah.
And the amazing group of people that he's got coming to perform. I'll give him a chance to talk about it, but I did want to say thank you. Not just on behalf of, you know, I'm here sort of representing Montrose Counseling Center, but on behalf
of... You are Montrose Counseling Center.
No, I'm not. It's a wonderful, wonderful agency, and we're very grateful to be a beneficiary of the event. However, I just personally want to say thank you, because he's taken this on all by himself.
Now, Falcon, how did you get involved with the Illuminations Project?
Well, Illuminations Project kind of fell into my lap back in July. We were having our normal World AIDS Day Houston committee meeting.
And for our listeners, we started like early summer planning for this whole week, today and this week, for events and organizing that. So it didn't just happen overnight.
Oh, no. A lot of planning, a lot of hard work. And we got word that Illuminations Project may not happen this year because of other commitments from Jane Wiener at Hopestone. Jane's been doing this for the past 6 years. It's her dream. It's her idea of bringing awareness to your community through theater, through dance, through music, through comedy, whatever you want to do. But it's been her dream for the past 6 years. And it's something that when we were talking about it in July, we were very concerned about it not happening. So I kind of took this on. And along with Karen Singer and Matt Harris, we kind of put our heads together and came up with an idea for the show. And of course, Jane being from New York and performing on Broadway and stuff, I don't have those connections. She used to bring in some wonderful performers from New York. And so this time I just went out to the Houston community and said, would you perform in this show? And I got to tell you, I sent out the letter. I went to the Hobby Center. They're pretty well on board. They said, get your entertainment together first and then come back and talk to us. And I got to tell you, I sent out all these letters to all these different performers and all these groups and wonderful companies. And I wasn't hearing anything. And man, you want to talk about your heart sinking at first. And I kind of gave them a deadline, and I swear to God, like 48 hours before the deadline is when the phone started ringing, the email started coming in, and the letters started coming in. I'm going, oh, we've got a show. So I was happy. So we got some wonderful people in the show. And what the show is about is awareness, of course. We start the show out. This year it's going to be a little bit of a different format. I'm going to be introducing the show and welcoming the guests in. And then we're going to start with the productions, and we're going to have Hopestone. They're going to have a couple of performers there. The Houston Metropolitan Dance Company. We've got Resurrection MCC, the Houston Ballet, the Debris Sisters, the Houston Flyboys, which watch out. They're going to do a fantastic number, which, you know, if you're in the front rows, you're going to get covered with confetti, I think.
Oh, don't give that away.
We got to give it away. It's too good
you
of a
might
show.
Get covered with confetti.
You
there's
might. You
not, no.
Well, it's any, a Gallagher
there's,
show.
There's no guarantee.
Right, no guarantee.
No guarantee.
At any gay event, that's a possibility. You know?
It's more likely it'd be glitter.
It could be glitter, something fabulous.
We also got Sean Welling's Planet Funk, the City Ballet of Houston. We got the Gill family, the Lone Star Lariat, Sarah Schoenlander, Urban Souls. And
Cheyenne?
The show is going to end with... you got to be there. It's going to end with Cheyenne, and she's going to be backed up by two gentlemen from the Houston Met. And it's going to go right into the Illuminations Project. And some of the things we're doing differently this year is we are going to have an intermission. I don't want to do 14 numbers in a row. So there will be a little bit of a break, but when we come back, we're actually going to do the award ceremony during the show. We give out wonderful awards. This is one of the few organizations that is not affiliated with anybody else. This is truly a community-based award. You nominate the people. We take the nominations. We have independent people look at the nominations and tell us who the winners are. And we're going to present them on Saturday night during the awards. It used to be done prior to the show, and nobody really knew who the winners were. So now we're going to make sure it's out there and everybody knows. It's a benefit this year for AIDS Foundation Houston, for the Montrose Counseling Center. And through ARESIS, it will be benefiting Legacy Community Health Services and Assisters. We still got some wonderful seats available. We are doing a special sponsorship. So many people with AIDS are living on disability, and a lot of their medication is taking away any extra money they may have. So what we're doing is, if you go to the website for the Hobby Center, www.thehobbycenter.org, there's a promo code, and all you got to do is put in donations, and you can reserve a seat for somebody with AIDS from one of our beneficiaries. So it's a wonderful way to give these people a chance to actually see what we're doing for them, a chance, you know, a Christmas present, however you want to look at it. It's something that they will never get a chance to see normally without having to shell out a lot of money for it.
And you got a couple of donations for that tonight.
I didn't want to. I was trying to be very professional with the candlelight visual, but Sally gave me some donation and bell mitts. And, you know, it's really great. I did a show on Saturday night at EJ's, a benefit show. So we raised, I think it's $1,280. That's all going to go for the tickets. And what I actually did is, I think it's all set today. I mean, I had to get a hold of the Hobby Center today, but the sponsorship should only be $15 for tickets now. We lowered the price because we want to see how many people with AIDS we can get to see the show.
We want to fill up the theater for sure. This is in Zilka Hall, right?
Zilka Hall, at the Hobby Center.
500 seats, I think.
500, exactly, yeah.
And it's at 7:30 on Saturday, December 6th.
December 6th, yep.
And you can go to the website and get tickets right now?
Yes.
Thehobbycenter.org.
And this is co-sponsored with ARESIS. So anything that you give would be a donation.
What is ARESIS? There may be listeners out there that don't. They're living under a rock.
ARESIS is the Empire of the Royal Sovereign Imperial Court of the Single Star Incorporated. And I'm a member of ARESIS. And what we do is we are basically playing royal court as a theme. So we have emperors and empresses, and we have the whole royal line that goes all the way down. And right now, what we do is it's a theme in our fundraising endeavors. Instead of just getting together as a group and being, you know, what do we do this week? We actually play court. Now, out there in the United States, Canada, and Mexico, there are 72 other courts. So think about this. Within that whole international court system, we raise over $40 million a year throughout North America. And that's 1 year. ARESIS, over the 25-year history, has given... You got to sneeze, honey.
That's nothing to sneeze at.
$40 million is nothing to sneeze at.
So ARESIS, over its 25 years, has given away $1.5 million.
That's awesome.
So naturally, your donations now, I think you got to hit that $25 limit for it to be considered a tax deduction. So buy two tickets. I ain't goofy. But it is a tax deductible donation if you go to the website, because it is all funneled through ARESIS.
And for many people, I mean, it was rather cold this evening to go out to the candlelight vigil. And even if you weren't able to celebrate or observe World AIDS Day today in that fashion, this is an opportunity coming up this Saturday to show your support. At the very end of the performances, there will be a candlelight presentation, and the audience will be invited to come up on stage and light a candle. And so, you know, so many of us in this community have been impacted, whether it's somebody that we've lost, somebody that we know that's struggling with this disease, you know, and countless others. I mean, just, you know, how many of us know what it's like to have that HIV test and just sitting on eggshells wondering what the results are going to be? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be positive? Is it going to be negative? This disease impacts us so completely in our community that this is a chance for people to come out who may not have been able to come to the Candlelight Observance tonight, yeah, and to show their support.
Because, like Sally said, now after the last performance with Cheyenne, we will, this year, we're changing things up a little bit. The performers are going to come out and take their vows this time. But I'm going to be the very last one to come out. I'll take my vow, of course. After 6 months of doing this, I'm taking a vow.
Please do.
But I will be lighting the first candle. So that'll be the cue for everybody to come up. The performers will come out with the candles. And they'll come out with lighted candles. They'll also come out with unlit candles for people to come out and light them up. So it's a very... I'm going to tell you right now, Cheyenne's number. I'm one of those people that always try to end a show with a high note. But this is the type of show where this is about reflection. This is about what World AIDS Day means to you. Some people will look at it as a memorial. Some people will look at it as a celebration. Some people look at it as prevention and awareness and education and community. So however you want to look at it, that's wonderful. But we do invite the whole audience to come up and celebrate it however you want to celebrate it. Think of it how you want to think of it and light that candle.
That's what I really like about this year, is you kind of made it more of a community-involved event. You got different organizations in the community, different performers.
Yeah.
Instead of importing them from New York, which is great. You know, there's a lot of talent in New York, but there's a lot of talent here, too.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I like about this year's.
I kind of had to go with what I know.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, there's plenty of people here, you know, that can put on a show.
And trust me, I mean, the Houston Metropolitan Dance Company has really stepped up. They're doing two or three different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the opportunity to go to some of these people, the City Ballet, the Houston Met, and see some of it. When the Houston Metropolitan Dance Company, Cheyenne and I went there, and I got to tell you, they only had like 1 minute of the piece ready for me, and I got chills down my spine.
Oh.
That's how powerful the piece is. And I'm not going, oh my God. So for nothing else, people come out and see this show. It's going to be entertaining. I mean, we got some, it's not a downer show. We got highs, we got lows, we got camp drag, we got some fun stuff. We got, I try to put something in there for everybody. We got line dance, or line, how should I phrase it, country dance group. I don't want to call them line dancers because they do aerobics, they do pyramids, they do it all. But I try to put something in there for everybody. So, and hopefully next year, you know, when we do this again, I really, my idea this year was to make it about World AIDS Day. I try to get different cultures. I wanted to get, you know, something from Latin America. I wanted to get something, you know, culturally diverse throughout all of it. Hopefully next year people are listening. They'll contact their favorite dance companies and let me know. You can learn also more information about this by going to the MySpace page for Illuminations Project, which is basically Illuminations Project, MySpace/Illuminations Project. Or if you need more information, you can email me at illuminationsproject@yahoo.com. But, yeah, come on out, people. It's a great show. Regular seats right now is $35 for the orchestra and $25 for the mezzanine. And like I said, you can sponsor somebody for $15 a piece.
Now, give us the information on contacting you about tickets as well as the location and time again.
The tickets will be done through thehobbycenter.org. So it's www.thehobbycenter.org. Or you can call them up at 713-315-2525. You can get all your tickets. You can make the donation through there. You can get all your tickets through there. If you're buying regular tickets or donations, you can do it right through there.
And when is it?
December 6th at 7:30 p.m.
7:30.
I remember when we were talking Hobby about this Center? In July, and it seemed so far away. Now it's this weekend.
No, you tell me it's this weekend. Trust me.
So Saturday, starting at 7:30 at
yes.
the beautiful Zilka Hall at Hobby Center.
I still yeah. can't believe it's here.
Yeah,
I've done well, so much on this. And
you can purchase tickets at the box office. You can just show up and purchase tickets.
Oh, yes,
you don't have
definitely.
To buy them in advance. Yeah. So.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being here.
Thanks,
Sally
you.
Huffer, Falcon.
Thank you.
And, yes, the Illuminations Project this Saturday, 7:30.
at the Hobby Center.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you. Thank you.
In 1968, illumination happened in the form of a new church and a new movement. Today, queer communities around the world struggle for justice and hope. Those communities can look to us today because of the struggles and victories of the last 40 years.
He was an extraordinary boy with prodigal fashion flair.
Come on, let yourself be happy.
So let him know you're here to stay. Here to stay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Our news wrap crew took the week off to enjoy the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, but they'll be back next time with the latest developments in or affecting our global LGBT communities, including the passage of landmark same-gender couples legislation in Australia, observances of the 20th annual World AIDS Day, and a Florida judge ruling the state's ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians to be unconstitutional. On this special program, the casualties will be light when you step right up to the sweet life, and we'll bring you some other words and music that'll inspire you along the way.
Don't give me that.
In October of 1968, the idea that religion had anything but condemnation to offer LGBT people was unthinkable. Unthinkable, that is, to everyone except a gay former Pentecostal preacher named Troy Perry. Perry founded Metropolitan Community Church in Los Angeles, and MCC has grown to include LGBT-positive congregations around the world. When Perry retired as head of the denomination in 2005, the Reverend Elder Nancy Wilson was elected to replace him. In her keynote address at MCCLA's 40th anniversary celebration in October of this year, Wilson recounted highlights of the church's history and pointed to the present and future challenges for its global ministry.
In the beginning, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. In 1968, God said it again, and there was MCC Los Angeles, the first MCC church. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." Who knew before 1968 that he meant us? That we would be called to shine a light in so many places that needed illumination, including the church that bears his name, and many places the church would never dare to go. Troy Perry, who could have believed it 40 years ago now? My personal thanks to you. I discovered MCC in 1972, when MCC was 4, not 40, and I was 22, in my first weeks of seminary, I met you in the parlor of Arlington Street Unitarian Church in Boston when you jumped to your feet to greet me in that cassock and surplice and those sideburns. You were larger than life and filled that tiny chapel with the most amazing blend of gospel preaching and justice, radical justice speak, that swept me off my feet. I knew then that this moment, this path of illumination, was worth living and dying for. It was worth risking everything for. In 1968, illumination happened in the form of a new church and a new movement. Only 14 years later, we would be so grateful for that church and that movement in the face of HIV/AIDS. Today, queer communities around the world struggle for justice and hope. Those communities can look to us today because of the struggles and victories of the last 40 years. When I think of MCC Los Angeles and MCC in that first decade, I think of 1977. I was a new elder showing up for my third meeting in Los Angeles. But Troy was not there. He was fasting on the steps of the federal building to raise initial funds to fight the Briggs Initiative. So we scuttled our agenda, we worked with MCCLA members, and we got on the phones. There was no internet, very primitive forms of communication in those days, and we spent days calling MCC churches and everyone we knew to raise $100,000, which then was like $1 million. Just weeks before, Troy had been at a national gay meeting in which the leaders said we should not fight these state-by-state battles. But Troy broke rank with them. He saw California as a do-or-die state. Do you hear me? Yes. Sound familiar? Proposition 8 today. This was a must-win when no one thought we could win. So he was fasting on the steps of the federal building with the national leadership of the gay community madder than hell at him. Our church is frantic and worried. People spread false rumors about him that he wasn't fasting. For a while, it looked bleak, but we kept at it. We raised the money, which funded the first poll ever taken that helped set the strategy that won that day. National leaders came to know he was right, and some of them even admitted it eventually. Troy trusted God and his own political instincts. What mattered was getting the job done. MCC Los Angeles, God said, "Let there be light," and you gave birth to a movement, to a denomination, to a Latin ministry that thrives and saves lives today, to a synagogue, to the largest LGBT center in the world, to national groups like HRC, and to things like queer theology. You know, we've done queer theology. You, MCCLA, have done queer theology every Sunday for 40 years in sermons with new songs. You were doing queer theology before anyone ever called it that. And now, perhaps a mosque. MCC Los Angeles, when I think of you and the nearly 15 years that I had the privilege of being your senior pastor, I think of a cast of characters that you, and you all know what I mean, and you all have your lists and your stories. Okay, I'm going to remember Johnny Matthews today. Anybody remember Johnny Matthews? Yes. Was she queer, lesbian, trans? I have no idea. She wore a yarmulke. She was hard of hearing. She had a bad speech impediment. She was noisy. She came late to church. She was argumentative. She talked at the top of her lungs. She always needed a ride, usually from me, and always monopolized newcomers, especially good-looking women. Angels in strange forms. At her funeral, a very attractive heterosexual woman who for the first month thought Johnny was just this nice old man, said, "Well, I figured if you could accept her, then surely you could accept me." The first AIDS vigil at MCCLA in late 1986 in downtown Los Angeles. We kept the church open 24 hours, a very scary thing to do on Hill Street. And I was a little worried about security, so I contacted the guardian angels, and they stood guard all night at our church through that AIDS vigil. MCC LA fought for the very first AIDS hospices ever built, and then welcomed rent-free on our property the first pediatric AIDS residence ever in the world. Later, many years later, on Sundays, teams of us would go out to hospices all over L.A. visiting. Some were beautiful, state-of-the-art places. Others were run-down nursing homes. The whole gamut. One of our board members worked for the Broadway department store when it still existed. And, you know, they had these gorgeous, large, white, plush bears with red ribbons for Christmas. Well, I guess they had too many, wink, wink, because many dozens of them showed up on our doorsteps that Christmas Eve. I went with one team to one of the worst places where drug addicts and old drag queens went to die. We offered one of the bears to one woman who was so grateful she just sobbed. When she could finally speak, she told us she was crying because the next day, Christmas, her mother was bringing her 6-year-old daughter to visit. And she had been fretting all day about having no gift to give her on this last Christmas. And now she had this beautiful bear. That's a quintessential MCCLA story. It is what you do and have done over and over and over again. MCCLA, you loved, touched, prayed for, buried hundreds. We ministered to thousands and still do of those affected and infected by HIV/AIDS. And I remember when we moved into West Hollywood and there was that horrible rain and someone saying to me, "Pastor, did you know there's a hole in the roof?" Just a year later, which was 10 years ago at our 30th anniversary, we learned of the deadly attack on young Matthew Shepard. It was on this anniversary, 30 years, that same night, we learned of it. After dinner, the youth group and youth leaders took the tarp that had been on the roof during all that rain of that previous year and made a huge sign that hung out in front of the church that said, "Pray for Matthew." When he died, Troy and MCCLA staffer Reverend Don Wilder went to the funeral in Laramie, Wyoming, and Jesse Jackson spoke at the rally and press conference in our sanctuary. The place was jam-packed on a Tuesday in the middle of a week. We held the vigil and memorial in front of the church, projected songs onto the side of the building. We spoke to 5,000 people in the streets. MCCLA, you helped our people grieve and challenge the anger. We stood up against the violence. We've known wildernesses in 40 years, have we not? Briggs Initiatives, Anita Bryant, AIDS, fires, murders, vandalism, persecution, earthquake, Pete Wilson's vetoes, and Proposition 8. And we've seen the promised land of equal rights, marriage equality, strong, thriving institutions. But at 40 MCCLA, you have only just begun. There are places crying out for safety, safe space, and human dignity right here in North America. There are places that have no safe space, no sanctuary, no place where a young person can find community, hope, and friends, no welcoming churches, no PFLAG. The Latin ministry that you founded and have nurtured needs to be part of a plan to plant 100 ICMAs in North America to an underserved community. Today, in Pakistan, queer people live in fear for their lives. Same-sex couples cannot live together. Lesbians struggle for basic human rights and dignities. Eunuchs and trans people live in squalor and are in constant danger. When MCC leaders visited Pakistan this year for the first time on our 40th anniversary, amen, they met with several groups, including a group of lesbians. These young women meet secretly and are pooling their resources, sending each other to beauty school one by one so they can have a beauty parlor that doubles as a residence. Why beauty school, you ask? This, in Pakistan, is the one social place where women can live and congregate unmolested. One of them also wants to go to seminary. Our global justice team and Region 1 are committed to making this a reality. It costs $1,500 to educate one woman to go to beauty school and help her gain her freedom. MCC, these are our people. Queer people in Pakistan know we are here, whether they're Christian or Muslim or whatever their religious background. They know we will care. Our presence has already begun to make a difference. A light is being lit in Pakistan. In Nigeria today, Rainbow House of Prayer, MCC, is under attack. We had to sneak the pastor out of the country 2 weeks ago. Members are being attacked physically. Services are suspended. We need to create safe space for our community in Nigeria and not abandon them in their time of need. When AIDS activists in Uganda were arrested and attacked earlier this year, MCC members and leaders were there and with the UN rallied the world to insist that these young activists be released from prison, which they were. A light has become a firestorm of demand for human rights for sexual minorities in Africa, and MCC is fanning the flames. Nearly 3 years ago, the LGBT community in Jamaica lived in fear and despair. As leaders were murdered, no one was held accountable, and there was no hope. Today, there is a thriving indigenous metropolitan community church with 150 members who meet monthly for worship and weekly in four cities on the island. At last, human rights and civil rights for LGBT people is a topic of public discussion. And now almost weekly, human rights allies in Jamaica are speaking up and out. A light has been lit and can never go out. in the hearts of brave young men and women of Jamaica who embody the best of the future of MCC. And finally, this is no time to be satisfied or complacent. It is true that in the U.S. and in some other countries, lesbian and gay, if not bi and trans or leather people, have a choice of places to go to church, especially in major cities and regions. And that's wonderful, the fulfillment of a dream. But MCC, we came here to do a lot more than that. In the U.S., young people constitute the most unchurched generation ever. And they are not looking for an institution to prop up or an organization to join. They are looking for people to change the world with, for a movement that cares about the things they care about, that is queer enough and radical enough to honor those who in 1968 risked lives and reputations to challenge the church, laws, nations, so that those on the margins could have hope and community. People who knew then, as we know now, that Jesus does not discriminate. We have to change our country. We have to change the priorities of our country. The last few bizarre weeks are surely telling us that, if nothing else. Justice and peace and dignity and hope for all. Food and health care as a basic human right. An environment that is not being destroyed and poisoned. These are the things young people care about. These are the priorities that must be ours. Board and lay leaders in MCC LA, we in MCC around the globe need you. We need your spirit, your energy, your creativity, your holy boldness, your resources, your people as never before. We need you to still be the gay church where the gay church is needed, to be the trans church or the AIDS church or the mother church or the human rights church. We are proud of you. We believe in you and in the future you represent. Someone called me the other day and asked me if MCC, we are making plans if the U.S. economy failed. I just want to assure everyone in this room that economic woes or challenges will not stop us. The religious right or fundamentalists in any culture will not stop us. AIDS will not stop us. Failure or success will not stop us. Death threats or bigots will not stop us. The light is on, and it's not going out. We have a cloud of witnesses, don't we? Watching tonight. Think of them right now. They are waiting for us to have the kind of courage it took to found MCC. And to find it all over again. To fall in love with the impossible dream of a rainbow people of God. They held up the light for many of us. And now it is our turn to hold it up for a new generation. MCC Los Angeles at 40 years young. You are about something powerful being illuminated in the human spirit. You are about something God still wants to do. Something that is not finished yet. Amen.
That was Metropolitan Community Church's moderator, Reverend Elder Nancy Wilson, speaking in October at the 40th anniversary celebration of MCC Los Angeles. For more information about Metropolitan Community Churches, log on to mccchurch.org.
This is Queer Voices.
With us on the line is Nancy Ford. Good evening.
Yes, I am here. How are you, Jack?
I'm doing fine this evening.
Good.
This seems like something that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about it?
Oh, the Judy Garland? Yeah, I can't wait. But before I get into that, may I just quickly say... I guess you don't say Happy World AIDS Day, but recognizing World AIDS Day to everybody out there who has HIV or been affected by HIV just, you know, it's just a very special time for everybody. And I was at the World AIDS Day luncheon today, as was Brian. And,
yes,
and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time and very inspirational. And I just wanted to toss that in before we start talking about the fun stuff, because it was just, it's a very special day.
Well, it's not only a day. It's actually like a week and a half of activities that's going on. It's sort of like Pride Week, you know, that you got so many different activities.
Yeah.
Actually, I think you probably have more things going on now with World AIDS Day than we do with Pride.
That could very well be. But like I said, I just wanted to, you know, pay a bit of homage to it. And thank you for having me on the air. I really appreciate you having
me. Well, you're more than welcome. You know, I actually do remember the Judy Garland show.
From the original broadcast in 1963?
Yes, because most other people were watching Bonanza, but I was watching Judy Garland.
That should have told you something right there, Jeff.
Yes.
Yes, it's very exciting. It was a taping of the 1963 Judy Garland Christmas special. She had a series on, and this was a special. Well, in fact, let me just read directly from the... From the
1963
here.
Press release?
Yes, it's a little yellow, a little frayed around the edge. Spend an unforgettable Christmas at home with Judy Garland and daughter Liza Minnelli, Mel Torme, Jack Jones, and Judy's younger children, Lorna and Joey Luft, and enjoy one of television's most charming, captivating, and entertaining holiday treasures. Broadcast on December 22, 1963, as a special installment of the Judy Garland Show, this warm and wonderful hour features dozens of seasonal favorites and great tunes, including Judy's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which, this is not on the jacket, she messes up so badly. It is just, it's so special. But back to the jacket. Little Drops of Rain, Arousing Consider Yourself from Oliver with Liza, Lorna, and Joey, Jack Jones' Lollipops and Roses, and Judy and Mel's duet of his holiday evergreen, The Christmas Song.
Where did you get this?
Well, I saw it. Well, you can get it online.
Oh, okay.
Actually, anyone can pick it up. But I just happened to see it on Nick at Night several years ago and tuned into it. And it is truly Judy at her ripest. It's we all love Judy Garland, and she has the voice to die for.
Yes.
But this is as Judy is getting a little bit older, and you can tell she's really enjoying her holiday cheer. And it's a live show, you know. They taped it live, but it was it's quite freewheeling, and it's a wonderful way to sing along with your friends on the holidays, and also, you know, have a good way to raise some money for our wonderful beneficiaries.
So this is going to be happening this Sunday.
It's going to be happening this Sunday at In-N-Out, which is at 1537 North Shepherd in the Heights. And we're also going to have a special appearance by the Houston Pride Band Sax Ensemble. Our friends there, and we know how wonderful the band is. Love those guys. Some special guests. We're going to have a wonderful raffle of several different prizes, holiday-type prizes that will make people happy. And a lovely buffet. It started out to be light hors d'oeuvres, but it's turned into this whole feast. So for a mere donation, or a donation of a mere $20, come watch the show with us, sing with us, enjoy some holiday music, have some food, and good cheer with good friends.
Okay. That sounds like a wonderful time, and especially the campiness of Judy Garland.
Very, very campy.
I've never seen the special.
Well, it includes a whole chorus line of dancing Santa Clauses.
I guess I should clip my gay card because I haven't seen that. But I would...
It's really funny. And Liza is dancing with her, who they describe as her boyfriend. But it's, I don't know, my gaydar is pretty good, even, you know, with black and white 1963 television. This boyfriend is gay. He's gay. He's gay. Liza, he's gay. He's gay. It was the beginning of a long road.
There's no use telling her because it's still, you know, she still goes for these guys.
And you know, some things never
change. She likes the artsy types.
The sun rises in the east, and Liza loves the artsy types.
Well, I hear she's going back to Broadway.
Well, she was... Did you happen to see her on Rosie O'Donnell's special last week?
No.
No, I heard the show was pretty bad.
Well, you know... I love Rosie, and I love Liza, And let's leave it at that.
Okay. But, and I do, too.
But
I
separately, too. They're great, but together, not so good? Is that what you're saying?
No, well, I think the show is just bad for what I mean.
But I'd still watch it anyway because it's simply Liza Minnelli. It doesn't matter what Liza does. It doesn't matter what Judy does. They're both icons, and what better time than the holidays to enjoy the holidays with them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I hope everybody comes out.
So what else are you up to these days?
Well, you know that magazine. What's the name of that magazine that you can pick up various... Oh, Outsmart. That's what that's called.
That keeps you busy during the day.
Outsmart is actually one of our fine sponsors of the Judy Garland Christmas special. So you'll see many of the Outsmart gang out at the show on Sunday night. Yeah, we're doing real well. We're working on our special January, you know, first issue of the year, and that always contains our big Astrocast that Lily Roddy writes for us. So we're working on that right now.
And, yes.
And December is actually, I believe December will be out on the streets tomorrow. So enjoy
wow.
that.
Great.
I know.
Great. What more can you ask for? The end of the hurricane season and Outsmart.
I know. I know. Is it the end of the hurricane? Oh, yes, it is, because it's December 1st.
It's December 1st, yes.
Why can I eat the leftover cans of tuna that are stacked up in the corner of my living room now? Ay, ay, ay.
You never know when you're going to need them.
You never know. You never know, and that's Spam. Everybody needs a can of Spam to fall back on.
So getting back to this, what is your participation in this?
Oh, well, how can I describe this? I guess I'll be narrating it.
Okay.
It's the best way to describe it. Like, I'll be alerting people to okay, watch out. Here goes Judy walking into a wall, which she actually does at some point. And, you know, just little offhand quips like that. And I'll probably sing a song or two and just kind of keep the show rolling.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
I hope you can make it.
Well, I hope to make it, too, because and it's great. In and Out's a nice bar, too.
I've never been there.
It's great, and it has the entire wall that's like a projection wall. So it's going to be Judy Garland, 12 feet tall? And she's only 4 feet tall, like in real life, only 4'9", or something like this, so...
Right, right. You know, and I think that was trying to counter-program Bonanza when they put her on. And, you know, the thing of it is, she's such a great artist, but I don't think she was quite all with it those days.
Well, only 1 in 10 were watching her. Get it?
Yes.
Oh, there you go.
That'll put a spin on you.
Even if we didn't know at the time, right.
Even if we didn't know it.
Yeah, something drawing you in.
I remember seeing Barbara Streisand on that series, on
too.
The Judy Garland
yes.
series. And you could tell they were just dueling divas.
Absolutely. Well, Nancy, thanks for calling us in. Let's give the information one more time.
Absolutely. It's the Judy Garland Christmas Special. The Kindred Spirits Foundation is producing it, the gang who puts on the big Kindred Spirits parties every year. It's this Sunday, December 7th, at the In-N-Out Club, which is 1537 North Shepherd. Donation of $20 will get you some food and fun, and everybody come on out.
Great. Well, thanks for calling in, Nancy.
Thanks so much.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
It's that time of year again when many of you in the U.S. consider ways to maximize your annual charitable tax deductions. Unlike many other worthwhile causes, we can't survive without your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to get some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives and further reduce your U.S. tax liability. No matter where you are in the world, we can't go on without you. Log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. From the This Way Out family to you and yours, thank you and happy holidays.
This week's edition of This Way Out is brought to you by the Rainbow Amateur Radio Association, serving GLBT ham radio operators all over the world since 1995. Weekly RadioNet meetings are conducted over various frequencies and over the Internet. For more information about this fun hobby, please visit www.rara.org or in the U.S. call 954-502-6969. We'll close out this week's special show with an optimistically upbeat edition of the Audiophile.
Canadian artist Jeffrey Straker has just released his second CD. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. The album title commands you to step right up.
He was an extraordinary boy with prodigal fashion flair. And high school girls have swooned in his enigmatic air. And eight great tables turned in, cats jumped out of bed.
My favorite review of this album says that if Jeff's songs have elements of wackiness, it's always inspired wackiness.
The album is getting a lot of comparisons to early Elton John material meets Rufus Wainwright, perhaps meets a little bit of Mika because of the vocal. And some reviews have recently commented on the interesting characters that are in the song and have made reference to that it might be potentially the soundtrack to a yet-to-be-written musical.
Find out more about Jeff Straker and his album, Step Right Up, at www.jeffstraker.com. That's www.jeffstraker.com.
Sweet Life is the ninth album by Keke Curtis and the first one recorded in Nashville.
I'm gonna throw these photographs away. I don't know why these memories got saved.
With all the world's current problems, this CD is striking in its optimism.
The new album is called Sweet Life, and it's a collection of songs that were written against the backdrop of sort of a troubled world, but the songs are focusing on beauty and joy, resilience, and connection between people.
I had lots of big plans for tomorrow.
You can learn more about Keke Curtis and her new album, Sweet Life, at www.katiecurtis.com. And Katie is spelled C-A-T-I-E.
Daddy told you something about the way the world runs. Lay the law on who you are and who you're supposed to love. Detailed expectations for the futures of his own. 'Cause no pansy little homo boy is welcome in his home. And you don't have a thing to say, but nothing's gonna change.
we're very pleased to feature Phil Putnam again on Audiophile. He's just released his sixth album called Casualties.
Casualties is about growth, and that's really the core of it. Growth in my musical sound with a lot more electronic music and programming, as well as some string quartets and some woodwinds. It's also about personal growth, and the songs really tell the stories about my journey and my efforts to have the way that I see myself now not be shadowed by the way that I've seen myself in the past.
Was he made for something more than this old world and this old life of vice? And he wonders how his life could look to the angels who guard him at night. Are they working for a worthy cause, or is he just a waste of their pride?
Find out more about Casualties, the new album by Phil Putnam, at www.philputnam.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
So dig down, sit still, 'cause this could get messy. 'Cause what would you kill to find a way to fit, find a way to fit, find a way to fit in here?
Join the Audiophile crew for their annual special Year in Review program during the week of December 29th. You'll hear our regular news wrap segment on the next edition of This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Lucia Chappell, Christopher Gall, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Reverend Dolores Berry, Jeff Straker, Katie Curtis, and Phil Putnam performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Special thanks for their generous donation this week to the Rainbow Amateur Radio Association. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to postal mailed CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, KFAI Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
And this community radio station is KPFT Houston. Coming up in the next couple weeks, on the 22nd, we'll be doing the Christmas special, Queer Music Heritage, which is done by J.D. Doyle, who you just heard on Audiophile. We also have a couple other things. Next week, we're going to have John Wright from the Dallas Voice. He is like one of the very few, actually, full-time GLBT reporters in Texas. And the Dallas Voice is a great newspaper, so he'll be talking about some of the issues going on in Texas. We also have a couple other things scheduled next week, including...
We have the diva herself, Julie Eberle, coming on from the Center for AIDS to talk about a special fundraiser coming up. And also...
We're going to interview Todd White with Santa Land Diaries at the Alley Theater.
I'm looking forward to that because the original David Sedaris Santa Land Diaries that appeared on National Public Radio was just sort of what... launched his career as a great, great storyteller. And you hear him a lot on This American Life, which is heard here on KPFT, I think, Monday afternoons.
Also coming up this Wednesday is the Houston GLBT Political Caucus at 7 o'clock over at the Haven Center. So if you haven't been active in the community as far as politics is concerned, come over and hear it. Part of the Ray Hill will be speaking and talking about milk.
And he's always entertaining.
Yes, he is.
And speaking of milk, coming up just very shortly in the second hour, we have some interviews of the person who directed the movie, Gus Van Sant, and the writer of the movie. And if you haven't seen it,
you have to go see it. Oh, my God. And go see it at the River Oaks Theater.
Well, that's the only place you can see it
right
now. Well,
please go support that theater. I mean, this is a tremendous movie. I had high expectations, but I think my expectations were exceeded because of the acting and just the ensemble cast. And
the people I've talked to about it, they say that he really portrays the
people that
accurately.
Knew Harvey say it's very accurate. And you know what I like was the kind of the setting and the 70s look of San Francisco, how they did that. They recreated the whole thing.
They did an incredible job. And in fact, we did a great interview with Ed Barnes and Ray Hill, who both met him. And Ed Barnes actually lived in San Francisco and sometimes rode the bus.
I was thinking about that while I was watching the movie. He was talking about the couch. And in the movie, you see the couch where everybody's kind of hanging out and, you know, talking.
That's the exact location. They were able to rent out the same space and put that movie together. So the details of bringing it back to the late 70s and trying to get as much as possible about the way it felt and the way the city felt, et cetera, et cetera. Well, let's go right into that interview.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
Diego used a word several times during our session with him that I wanted to start with asking about important and the sense of the importance of telling this story. And I thought, okay, is that something that can overwhelm the storytelling when you feel like we are, you know, it's important that we get this right. We have a responsibility to the real people. How do you balance that with the needs of drama to say, you know, we want real people, we're not... No, we don't have halos here.
Well, I can tell you where I started with it. I mean, it being important is what brings you to it. You know, it's important to you. It touches you in some way. Like, you know that in your first instincts, your first brushes with the story. But then, yeah, you put that aside because then you have to get into the nitty-gritty of who these people were. And you can't write from it being important or not. You can only write, for me at least, from it being truthful or not. And in that process... you find out, you know, how human these people really were through the research, through the actual writing.
You mean like overplaying your hand, like making it seem like it's corny because it's like too important? Or I mean, it's a dramatic. I think all dramatics, like, they start with like whatever your theme and whatever your if it's a heroic story, an important story, it's. You know, you have learned, hopefully, through trial and error, how to construct something that's not, you know, corny. You know, if it's a love story, you don't want to like be mushy. You know, it's that thing. So that the importance of the story doesn't get in the way of the dramatics. You know, it's the strength, you know, of the dramatics. And you obviously can overplay it and be ham-fisted or whatever, which I think at times we are. But you also, that can help too, like being ham-fisted at the right time is good.
But you don't want the audience to feel like it's medicine, say, oh, this is an important film, you have to go see it.
Well, I never thought, actually reading the script, you find that out as you're reading it. It was never, when Lance wrote it, was never the type of thing where it was presented like you really should be reading this. And scripts can be like that. You know, and movies can be like that.
Nance, when did you start working on this? Because given everything that's happened with the election, mm-hmm. with Prop 8 especially, it's almost eerie to see this film right now. And we know it happened in the 70s, and it's happening right now.
Right. Well, it happened in the 70s, but it also happened in, like, 2000 with Prop 22. And, I mean, it's been happening. They keep coming up, these propositions in California. And so... I started in 2004, I think, right around there, like really doing the research trips and hanging out with Cleve and driving up to San Francisco to meet the rest of the, you know, surviving folks from Harvey's posse. And, well, what was the rest of that question?
Who knows?
Who knows? No, it was... Sorry, my coffee hasn't quite kicked in yet.
But meeting those guys, were they open to talking about it? Or, is, you know, I mean, it's painful, I would imagine, too.
Oh, you know, it is. You know, they were, some of them were very, very open. I mean, Cleve was immediately, you know, threw the doors open and opened up the boxes of research and photos and showed me Harvey's bullhorn and all that sort of stuff. But then there, you know, there were others who, you know, told these stories time and time again. Sometimes with good results, sometimes with no results, and these are, like you say, painful memories for them. So there was some convincing to do. There was some convincing to do, and there wasn't like a studio behind it at the time, so that sort of made it a bit more difficult. But you know,
but maybe also like good, because they thought, oh well, this guy's never gonna. I can tell him the secret stuff because
that's true. They did get very, very open with me. At certain points, interesting, and you would you know, team them up, like, especially because they're pretty funny and they know each other really well. Like, if you put Jim Arvaldo and Mike Long in a room, they start to correct each other and call each other out on, you know, whether or not they're telling the truth or sort of telling the legend of their story. So, you know, eventually it felt like a family, and eventually, you know, I was able to get the specifics that you really need to make, you know, these characters feel real. And to really discover who Harvey was, not just the legend of Harvey Milk, but the real Harvey Milk, the man who, you know, was at times troubled and kind of a failure in many ways. And, you know, learning those pieces of his history that aren't always out there and sort of some of the lionizations of him that are the public dialogue about him.
For the longest time, it looked like this wasn't going to get told at all. And then it looked like it was going to get told twice. And I just wondered, did any of that affect what you guys were doing? The little War of the Milk movies there for a while?
Well, when I first started, there wasn't, you know, a War of the Milk movies. When I first started, I didn't know, you know, that project was alive anymore, because it had been sort of quiet for quite some time. You had been involved with that for a bit.
Yeah, I think by the time when Lance... brought the script over, which is a year and three quarters ago, almost 2 years ago. it had been in a state of, the Warner Brothers project had been in a state of somewhat dormancy, because it had been, you know, 16 or so years, and it had been in and out of different incarnations, and there was a new incarnation with Bryan Singer, but he was very busy. And it was just one of those projects, like in development type of projects, that I think it only affected us in the sense of, like, you know, if we start going on it, does that make the other projects start going too? Which I think existed for us. We never really knew what was going on. We were sort of in the dark. It was very, spy versus spy.
Yeah, you'd hear. Yeah.
Yes, can you tell us about using the same locations and, you know, what it took? Was it easy? Was it difficult to get people to agree to, like, the camera story? Tell us.
No, it was, I think when we first got to San Francisco, it was, there was a film board. The city really hadn't had that many films come there, because it's really hard to sort of find places to put the vehicles. It's hard enough for the San Franciscans to find parking, and they used to park catty corner on the walk like areas of the block, and that was legal because there just wasn't parking. And for a movie company in the hills, it's just really a pain. And I think that's, I guess that's one of the main reasons. The unions have a weird crossover, and the theatrical laborers work on film sets. You know, there's a kind of strange crossovers, but the locations were really quite easy compared to stuff like that. They were, the shop was a, it's a place, it's a gift shop called Given, and they were, they had a mural of Harvey inside the shop, so they were very into the legacy of the store, and they were just willing to let us close their shop down, which meant, you know, not being able to sell like their things, and let us move our set in there for a couple of weeks. I think it was 2 weeks, or maybe 3 weeks, and that was relatively easy. The business association on the Castro was like very supportive. Most of the people on the street were really supportive of the project, and then the rest of the city was quite easy. Yeah.
But to follow up on that, what about the feeling you got when you walked into that shop and you realized that that's where, you know, Harvey Milk brewed all of this?
Yeah, there was kind of a, like, at times, because it is a set, you sort of think of it as a set, and every now and then you reminded yourself, like, wow, this is actually the view out the window, and there's a story that I always, like, tell. It's a ghost story where, during a shot in at night. Were you there that night?
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. Did
this.
You see that guy?
I never saw it.
There was a take where we were using sort of most of the room, but the camera was pointed in one direction, and there were three or four actors in the scene, and it's at night. I think it might have been the night where Anne Cronenberg, like, gets the endorsement for the Chronicle.
I was doing my cameo. I was outside.
And there were some people sitting in the sofa, which was out... side, and during one of the takes, just somebody walked in from outside and sat down in the sofa during the shot. And after the shot was over and we yelled cut, he got up and walked out. And so the actors were like, "Did you see that guy?" And I said, "Who was it?" I didn't see anybody. And they said, "No, somebody walked in and sat down and walked out." And I was asking him, like, what he looked like, and they kept describing Harvey, and I thought, well, maybe that was like the ghost of Harvey just sort of walking in for a brief second.
Would Harvey really walk in for just a brief second?
He would have knocked something over, I think. I didn't.
Yeah. Because we're not getting to talk to Sean, which is frustrating because he's in every frame of the film, and it's really an amazing performance. I want to get your sense of working with him, because I think that you drew him out and got him to create a character without the histrionics that had marked a lot of his more celebrated performances. There's a subtlety to it that really draws us, the audience, in. What kind of collaboration was that? And what, as a fellow director, what kind of person?
Well, having not worked with him on another project, this is the one time so far. He is really artistic and very, like, kind of a mad genius. And I had worked, our first AD was a good friend of Sean's and a good friend of mine as well. And he had been the first AD on Into the Wild and on a few of Sean's other movies. So sometimes, like, he would comment, like, how, like, sort of intense Sean was when he was creating something, and how he sort of, you know, burrowed into the material, and he really acted sort of like, I guess, you know, Picasso or somebody, you know, like, so there were discrepancies and oddnesses to, there was a madness to his method, and I always interpreted that to, like, the brilliance of his method and the success of his career, you know, how intense he is and how, you know, he is one of the best actors living today. So so we were sort of I was an observer to that at times. I was the ultimate, like, bouncing pad for his, like, experiments, and he trusted me a lot, so you know, so long as I was able to give him feedback, that was the collaboration, was like him coming up with stuff, and then me just sort of like saying, you know, encouraging this direction, that direction. There were a couple times where, you know, it seemed like quite crazy, actually, you know, like right before we shot, like there was some really crazy things going on. And it's good to go into those areas because, like, then you can finally get, like, the good thing. But it starts to get crazy at one point, you know. And then it sort of pulls itself out.
You know? What do you mean by crazy?
Well, just, you know, just the way, like, Sean was becoming, you know, his hair was becoming, like, Harvey's. And so it was like, how does that happen? And Harvey's younger years, the hippie years, how does that work? It was mostly, like, surface stuff that I was thinking of, the crazy part, like what he was wearing. Like, there was one scene that's no longer in the movie, he was wearing that straw hat, like, in the bar. Crazy in the sense that you're really trying a lot of things before you finally settle into the final character, which is sort of what you do. That's what we do as filmmakers. We were being really crazy with the camera. We were, like, going in one direction, then we decided, like, no, that's not working. We, like, took a U-turn. So we were also doing it. So, just crazy seeming, because, like, when you see a result of something, you sort of start to think, well, it's too much right now, you know. But then you pull it back, and then it becomes just right.
Justin, I mentioned this only because the press kit makes a point of saying that you come from a devout military Mormon upbringing. And most of the things you work on kind of fly in the face of that. Have you been shunned?
Excommunicated. Yeah, no, I have not been excommunicated, but, you know, I'm looking forward to it. One day they'll get me. And half of my family is still, you know, devout Mormon living in Provo, Utah. And, you know, no, I think it's the struggle of my youth was sort of trying to figure out how to be, you know, gay and also, you know, be Mormon, and eventually that just didn't work, and I had to let go of the, you know, the LDS church. But, you know, most of the stuff I've done has kind of addressed that. You know, Big Love, certainly, I got to dive in head first into that world. But this, you know, this especially, I just, coming from such a conservative, you know, background, I felt was probably helpful, you know, for me to understand probably the atmosphere for a young gay person growing up in the late 60s or 70s, and just understanding what it meant to have to stay closeted for your own safety was probably very helpful, I would think. At least it helped me understand perhaps where Harvey came from in his closeted years, and understand sort of the need to open up and to free yourself of that restriction.
I'm curious a little bit about Dan White, the research in Dan White. I mean, I know you talked to the actual people, like Cleve. Did any of his family ever say anything to you guys as you guys were making this movie, or are they really just in the background? How do they feel right now about this movie?
I'm not in communication with them, but I did meet with one member of the family and talked with him, and I met with one member of the police force who was kind of like a father figure to Dan. I mean, I wanted to understand the man. I wanted to see what Harvey saw in him, why Harvey tried to reach out to him. That was important to me. So it was good to get those first-hand accounts. I mean, that was always the goal of this, was to have all first-hand accounts. And so it was important to talk to the folks who, you know, cared for Dan White.
Did Sean stay in character?
No, not even between setups. That's not his style, which is kind of great. I can see the value of, like, staying in character day and night. But then the other side of it is you know, it's a character you put on. You know, that seemed to be his style. So literally, as soon as he yelled cut, sometimes, like, it was kind of shocking, actually, sometimes, because he was Sean all of a sudden. And then, like, on action, he was Harvey.
What's the hope you're going to take away from this one?
Well, I think that to me, the sort of overall theme is one of a portrait of a grassroots political organization that affects change in its community and that, you know, the small guy can do it. He can get somewhere and affect change, and that you can do it.
So, how did I get into the character? Studied, read, watched videos, stuff like that. I did meet with a member of the family, not for that purpose, though. Charlie, who's the son, stopped by the set, and Sean had connected with him, and he decided to come to the set one day. He was very happy that we were doing the film. I think he was appeased the fact that I was going to make his father into play him for the entirety of the film as some kind of monster. I said the more interesting question to us is why something like this happens and how we can learn from it. So Charlie was there. That was a very emotional moment for everybody, for both all three of us, me and Sean and Charlie. I did speak with some pro Dan White, you know, people who from the fire department and the police department. I was able to hear his confession, which was extremely informative to me, and somebody entrusted me enough to listen to that. So I was able to get enough information to finally, you know, hold it and say, okay, what do I want to do with this? How do I want to go about this? You know, it's a very, you know, he's a very simple character. He's a very simple-minded character, but he's very, you know, from an emotional point of view, extremely complex. Always has two or three or four things going on. He's constantly questioning himself, you know, feeling resentment that he wants to be liked, but wanting to connect with Harvey, but not liking that he wants to connect with Harvey, and not feeling like he has the skills to be able to play on Harvey's level, and yet he just came from a place where everybody had done nothing but praised him and his community, and then he was taken by the fire department and the police force and put on this pedestal to say, you're the great white hope to bring San Francisco back to what it used to be. And when the gay and lesbian movement was already going on and had a life of its own, and he didn't have the skills or the political wherewithal or the foresight to realize Harvey, this is that moment, and that will bleed into the, it will hit a peak and it will bleed into the mainstream, and then I can have my moment, and to, you know, have the savvy, the political savvy to know that this is not my opportunity right now, but that is now. So in that way, that's the human approach to the character.
So are you done with wacky politicians now, or?
Yes. Absolutely. No more.
What about the suggestion that Harvey makes that Dan may be one of us? Did that play into your...
Yeah, but how do you ever know? You know, and how do you play that? How do you play that? Maybe he didn't even know, you know? And maybe it doesn't exist. You know, I think the more interesting thing, even though it's a movie that revolves around the gay movement, gay and lesbian movement, the more interesting thing is his need to connect and his need to be liked. And, you know, you can read into it, you know, the scene that we do in the lobby, me and Sean, you know, where I may look at Sean's character too long and you go, Is that it? But that's the whole thing. You know, we look in these guys' eyes, we watch these guys' behavior, knowing they've done what they've done to try and educate ourselves to, if we see it again, to run from it. But sometimes there's nothing in the eyes that is defining. You know, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to just bring in as much as I could, because I do. I think he was going through 19 things at once, always, once he got in City Hall. Yeah.
Also, something you were saying, I think this what you said before answers this partway, but it would be awfully easy to cast him and say, okay, he's the bad guy, because we do know, going in, we know at the very beginning what he's going to do when we meet him. We know the course of his history.
Right.
So how important is it that he not be seen as just the bad guy, as the guy who pulls the trigger?
But he is the guy that pulled the trigger. So he ultimately is the bad guy, you know, in this situation. You know, nobody's bad all the time. I mean, there's a couple of them out there. There was like a Russian serial killer that was in a cage and looked like an animal and was frothing at the mouth, killed like 100 people. I would assume that guy's pretty bad all the time. But it's like Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer's one of the most horrible human beings on earth. But you do a story about Jeffrey Dahmer, and if you just have him killing people the whole time, you go, yeah, I already know that. The more interesting thing is, who is Jeffrey Dahmer? Where did he come from? What was the relationship with his parents? What is this? And then you follow that trajectory. How did this guy become what? That's what interests me. How did this guy become what he became? How did he get to the point where he actually made the decision that it was the only tangible thing that he could resort to? It was the only garnering back of any power, feeling that he had lost everything. You know, any kind of his legacy, his standing with his family, standing with his community, it was all gone. So that's the only thing that he felt like he could do. It's very sad, you know. But at the same time, it's why I like Bush. It's the same reason. You know, how did this guy become president twice? Don't know. I want to explore that for 5 months.
And then
pour it on to the people.
John, the last couple of years, I've worked with some of the best filmmakers around, period. Just... on a personal level, what has that meant for you personally and creatively?
Everything. Everything. I mean, it's meant everything to me. It's all I ever wanted to do. It was status, this, power, none of it. It was all working with great filmmakers, you know. I'll name drop right now. I got an amazing little note from Woody Allen yesterday, and it literally brought tears to my eyes. I was like, Woody Allen sent me a freaking note. You know, it was like the performance in W. And, you know, when you get to that point, you just like, just turn it in, man. Just go home now. I feel very grateful. I feel extremely humbled by, you know, and educated now. Because, you know, I've worked with people with a lot of ego, loud voices and the whole thing, and then I see the movies and I go, get it, you know. And then the through line with these filmmakers is that they're obsessed with storytelling. They're all geeks. They're all nerds. And I'm happy that I found a family, finally, you know, because it's about the storytelling. It's about how can we make the story better. It's not about, oh, I'm going to position myself here because I'm the lead actor, so I'm going to tell you what to do with your movie. It's none of that. It's just how can we make this the best story we can make it.
Was Woody's note followed by a script?
No. No.
Just to follow up, this
it's very sweet, though.
What has this year meant to you between No Country, W, and this? You've got great reviews all around. What has it meant to you when you look back at this year?
I thought I just answered that. Is that I feel good about it, I think.
Well, but personally, besides personally to you, I mean, you've been a working actor all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And now it just seems like... And a very good one. And now it seems like you're at the very top where when people think of...
I don't think I'm at the very top, by the way. You know, it's always going to fluctuate. That's the thing. That's what I've been doing it a long time, 25 years. And it's all been about fluctuation. I'm happy. I was happy before. You know, for me, the greatest thing about all this is that it's happened now when my kids are older, because I was able to raise my kids. I was able to spend a lot of time at home, you know. I think I made a good decision a few years ago when I sold the ranch and I got that money and I learned how to day trade and I learned, you know, more about my finances and took control over that and was able to make better decisions for myself because it meant something to me suddenly to look back and I go, I don't like what I'm looking back on. I want to look back on something better and I'm willing not to work until it happens, and if it doesn't happen, there's other things I can do to make money. That was very important to me. It's a very personal thing. I would never say, I think that's for everybody. I don't want to insult anybody because people have to do what they have to do. Only 1% of our union actually makes a living doing what we do. So I'm in an amazing position, and I have been for 25 years. So this whole thing of, like, you know, recently, you know, you know, you've been doing C-minus work and now you're finally doing A work and all that. I kill somebody when they say that to me because it is. It's insulting. I feel good about all the work. I feel good about the theater, too. You know, you weren't there because there were only 300 seats, but, you know, that's all right. You'll come and see the next play now that I'm doing so well.
Do you ever get nervous, though? I mean, do you still get nervous, or is it still exciting and stuff?
Extremely. more so, because there is more pressure because you're working with people who have incredible resumes. I like that. I like the pressure. I do like the fear, because once I got past the whole idea of, do I really want to do this, because he's in everybody's psyche and the feeling about him and this, and could I pull it off, and the fact that we're covering 37 years of somebody's life, which almost never happens. You know, with Milk, you're covering 10 years. With W, you're covering almost 4 decades. And so it's like playing 8 different characters as one character. So, but the fear is good, because it can create a lot of wonderful things, you know, as long as I'm open to it. So, you know, I got hives and then got over it and then did the role.
Just a curious question, as a young actor coming up, were you inspired by actors like Paul Newman or McQueen? Who are some of the guys you actually inspired you and helped?
Early on, I was inspired by the obvious, you know, Paul Newman and Brando and James Dean and all those guys. I don't know why, but it was who to be inspired by. And then later on, it became about other people. Became about whoever gave a great performance. Sean has always given amazing performances. Mickey Rourke gave amazing performances. There are a lot of people, you know.
Talking about how what this year has led to, I mean, you can't be immune to the buzz about possibly the award season coming up and people noticing, hey, this guy is doing some pretty good work. I mean, being in the best picture of last year can't hurt you feeling good about yourself, but would it feel good to get that nomination?
The thing is it's always in comparison, like you just said, it's always in comparison. Are we going to give the guy a nomination who did, you know, Thrashing? Or Mod Squad? Or, you know what I mean? It's always in comparison, which is not, it's not okay. You know, the performance is what it is. And the only reason, I mean, Oscars or whatever awards and all that, it's that people are paying attention to the movies. That's what's so great. People are moved by the part. I like the movies that we're doing. So, you know, if people were like, you know, do you hope to get nominated for Transformers? I'd feel a little differently. The fact that it's Milk or the fact that it's W, I do think they're important movies. I do think they ask important questions. And I do think that they're dealt with very sensitively, you know, regardless of whether people say, oh, I wish Oliver was more hard-hitting on W and all that. We, you know, when Oliver and I spoke about it, people come in with such baggage into the theater, especially with W, that you don't need it. You don't need it. It's more interesting to go in a different direction. There's already, you know, 90 percentile approval rating to 23%. There's already that baggage coming in. So you have to keep that in mind when you do a movie like that. So, to answer your question, yeah, it's all good, man. It's all good.
I ask you.
We don't pine for it. That's what we don't do. I mean, I hope.
Did you ever used to joke? I mean, you're probably... How old were you when all this happened? Well, you were 10 when Milk and Dan White and all that happened.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time when time had passed and people would start joking about the Twinkie defense. You know, did you ever joke about that?
Never. The only experience I had was there was an adult when I was getting into punk rock. There was an adult when I didn't shave my head. I cut my hair. It wasn't the greatest haircut, but I cut my hair, and an adult said to me, you look like Harvey Milk. And I remember that when I read the script, and I hadn't thought about that for a long time. So this was my version of, you know, him being able to get back at that comment. I didn't understand that comment then. And I look back on that comment, and it was such a discriminatory comment. And, it's too bad, especially to a kid, you know. So that kind of stuff, that's probably, you know, shaped why I am who I am today and why I do these things like with Howard Zinn and why I think it's okay to be outspoken about your opinions and not succumb to these people out there going, hey, you're an actor, why don't you shut up, you know.
If I get you to put on your stock market hat for a minute...
And bore everybody? No, sure.
What the hell is going on, first of all? But also, how do you deal with when you've got 1,000 points in the Dow, 1,000 points in 1 week? How do you maintain your sanity?
I don't trade every day. You know, we have a company, Market Probability, and we have a very specific type of trading that we do, and it's been extremely lucrative for all of us. We don't play against the market. You know, the natural inclination of the market is to go up very slowly. It's gone up very rapidly the last 5 years. We knew there was going to be a massive correction. We didn't think it was going to be this massive, but we stopped trading. So we don't have to deal with losses. You know, we were up until December, we were up 73% for the year, and we had done extremely well. And, you know, we still trade a little fluctuation, but it, within the specific trading that we do, it's the behavior of the market that is not set up for that right now, so we don't trade.
So how long? 5 years?
How long what?
How long before it equalizes?
Nobody knows. That's the thing. If everybody knew, everybody would make a lot of money. Nobody knows. I mean, right now with the election, you know, the president-elect, you know, and it started going down so rapidly, was extremely curious to me. I did not understand it. I don't think it will last much longer, but I'm, you know, I have no idea. That's why I don't trade right now. And when it finds its foundation, then we can springboard off something that is, you know, has some ground. Yeah.
And just recently, the thing you're producing, the People Speak.
People Speak.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Just to it's something that I'm doing with Matt Damon and Anthony Arnove and Howard Zinn. We gathered a lot of people together. We created, Anthony Arnove and Howard actually created live performances of some of the speeches that have been taken out of People's History of the United States. And, you know, some anonymous and some very famous. John Brown to Martin Luther King to, you know, Marion Edelman. And then what we did is we created something in at the Majestic Theater in Boston and had many, many people, Viggo Mortensen, Danny Glover, David Strathairn, a lot of different, Marissa Tomei, a lot of different performances for 1,000 people, had 19 cameras film that, did another one at the Malibu Performing Arts Center. I got Sean to do that, Eddie Vedder. We had Taj Mahal, Pink. We had Benjamin Bratt, Don Cheadle. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. A very, very proud of this. We have 96 hours of film that we're cutting together. We met with 9 cable networks in New York, and everybody's very excited about it.
Good, they're bidding on it now.
That was pretty freaking good, man.
Yeah, it was very good. Are you performing?
I am. I do. Yeah. A bunch of different ones. John Brown's one of them, though, because I couldn't think of anybody else.
Wow.
Yeah.
And can I ask you just, isn't it Nicorette? I am curious. I know I'm
Bubble Yum.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But how about also getting into the life of real people who made a difference in the world, but who were living their lives at the time with a sense of, as you described the relationship going on, when you realize that there may be people walking by the shot, the camera store set, who actually did know these people.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any experiences where somebody walked up to you and said, I knew Scott?
Well, yeah, I mean... Yeah, those people were like advisors on the movie, so they were there every day, like Cleve Jones and Danny Nicoletta and Frank Robinson, and some of them, you know, they're there. I think they're all in the movie. They play little cameos, not themselves, but other roles. And so they were there every day, and it was a very unique working on that set, especially in the camera shop on Castor Street. You know, it's. We shot in that building. The camera shop is now some other store. I'm not quite sure what it is, but they rented it. The film rented it and refurbished it to look like the old camera shop. And I remember when Frank Robinson, who was Harvey Milk's speechwriter, he also wrote the novels of the Towering Inferno. When he walked onto the set, and you know, I was sitting behind the desk, and you know, the other actors were there, and he like looked at me, and you could just see in his eyes, it was almost like he was being transported back. And from that moment on, he just called everybody by their, you know, character names, because those had been his friends. And it's not like he was a, you know, method actor or anything like that. It was just that, you know, he'd been, in a way, kind of transported back, and it was just almost, like, easier just to call everybody by their character names. And it was pretty amazing just being able to shoot there, like, probably the center, what had been the center of the gay movement in, you know, in the entire world. That was it. And to be doing it there, where it all happened, was very unique for me.
What was the reaction of the present-day community while you were there? I mean, Castro was still operating while you guys were making a movie. So how did they treat you?
It was very supportive. I mean, there was all, you know, I don't think Gus or, you know, any of the producers or anyone were at a loss for you know, getting background people, or, you know, there were huge marches and people just, you know, I think they had too many people. They just got more than they asked for, just because, you know, everybody in the community was so interested in being involved in this movie. So, I don't know. As far as I could see, the film was really embraced by the community.
Did you, like, you know, kind of gain a different sort of insight into play? You know, so often we see the guy out front. You know, that's the, like Harvey. We're familiar with him, but we don't think about the guy behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, when he's out doing the great stuff, this guy's making dinner and saying, come on, Harvey, you have to eat.
And yeah, and what about it? Just what was
what
it?
What kind of insight did they get playing that guy?
Well, what I think about, I guess the what do you call it, like the political wife or something like that, and about playing that role, I was very happy to do it. You know, and I think that, you know, that kind of role and the relationship that it created in the movie was very important to the movie as a whole, because this movie could have just been all politics and, you know, just his political career and, you know, and all that. But instead, you know, Gus has made a very intimate feeling movie. You know, you get to really see Harvey's personal life, what he was like as a man, as well as, you know, as a politician. And that is, I think, the main function of my role and of our relationship with the movie, is to really ground it emotionally and really round out the character of Milk and to show, you know, just what the lifestyle was like, you know, at the time and place. And you know, Gus has been trying to make this movie for 12 years, or maybe more, I don't know. And I've never read any of the earlier scripts, you know, before Lance's script, but what I was told is it was just too political, you know? It was just, also, there, I mean, maybe too focused on Dan White and his psychology, and, you know, it wasn't like, it was like Dan White movie, not Harvey Milk movie. And so Gus really refocused it and reoriented it so that it was about Milk, about the time, and about the place, and about the people there. And so that relationship really gives you access to what, you know, what that's like.
Did you know anything? I mean, you were born just a few months before all this happened.
You look at my birthday? 78, yeah.
So, you know, did you have a lot of learning to do, or did you just already know?
No, I didn't, sadly. I when I heard about the movie, I wrote Gus an email and said I wanted to be a part of it if I could. You know, I'd do whatever I could. And then he gave me this great role. And so when I was doing the research, one of the first things I did is I watched the Rob Epstein's documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk. And you know, it kind of felt familiar. Like, I recognized Harvey's face, you know, but I didn't really know his story, you know. And thinking back on it afterwards, I thought it was really sad that, you know, here I am growing up like in Palo Alto, 45 minutes away from where Harvey Milk, you know, lived and died, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't taught anything about him, and I was in the Bay Area, you know, and, you know, so, I wish they had taught me about him in school.
Why did you want to be a part, if you weren't familiar with the story, what prompted you?
Well, yeah, so, I'm the biggest Gus Van Sant fan. When I was in high school in Palo Alto, I would watch Jokes for Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho, you know, repeatedly. And this is before I really knew, you know, was doing any real acting or anything. I just, you know, I just fell in love with his movies. And then I met him. He came to a little play that I co-wrote. And this is years later in L.A. I co-wrote this play called The Ape and acted in it and directed it, and he came because we had a mutual friend, and that was like, you know, the best I could ask for out of that play in a little North Hollywood theater, and so I got to know him a little bit, Gus. I got to know Gus a little bit, and then I heard he was doing this movie like 2 summers ago. I heard he was doing this movie, and I wrote him. I was in England, and I wrote him an email and just said, my agent called me and said, he's doing Milk, to answer your question. He's doing this movie about Milk. And I did a little research on Harvey Milk, found out who he was. I found out that Gus had been trying to do this movie for, you know, 10 to 15 years. And I just thought, you know, A, he's Gus Van Sant, so I'd do anything with him. B, it's such a important story for him to tell, you know, he's been trying to tell it for so long, and so this is going to be a very important project for him, and see, it's such an important story, so you know, there's no other movie, you know, that I would want to be a part of as much as this one. It's like, you know, it's everything.
You know, everybody's just starting now to, I know it's so early, talk about award season. You're on every list I've read so far.
Really?
And how do you feel about it?
Did I sound surprised? I was like, oh, really?
Yeah, but how do you do that? Because you're going to be getting these questions for months now. I mean, it's got to make you feel good on some level, if not annoy you.
I don't know how to answer this. It's such an honor. I mean, it's really an honor. Anything I say is going to sound so stupid and cliche. It's really an honor. I went back to school, like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, just because I was so... Acting was, like, all I had. And it was the only thing I was doing. It was, like, where I put so much of my focus. And it was just kind of driving me crazy, just because... everything, how acting, you know, I believe, you know, movies are a director's medium, and so if I believe that, I have to, you know, realize as an actor, I have to turn everything over to the director, turn my performance over and everything, and so just having to come to grips with, like, that lack of, control over my ultimate performance and all of that, and then just having to think about other actors and competing with other actors and all of that, just like, was driving me, making me really unhappy. I really didn't like it, and so I went back to school, and it helped me, and it gave me something else in my life. And so what I try to do whenever anything, be it good or bad, about like my career outside of just the movie that I'm doing, I really just try to push it out of my mind. And it's really nice when, like, you know, I got, like, a nice little award at the Hollywood Film Festival, and it's, like, really nice, and I'm always grateful, but I really just... I just try not to think about it, because it drives me... It can drive me crazy.
I was going to ask you about that going back to school choice, because I thought that was interesting. Here you've got a career that is chugging along very nicely, and options big studio films and independent, you know, character driven films, and yet you have to sort of move away from that in order to find something else. Did you find it? Were you able to be a student at UCLA or a student at Tisch and not have people say, Harry Osborne's in the class, you know, that's her.
am I able to fit into the school?
Yeah, exactly, and get what you were looking
for. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm definitely able to get what I'm looking for. At UCLA, I was not. I don't think I was treated any differently. I don't think teachers hand out grades because good grades because you're in Spider-Man or anything like that. Yeah, and the students, like every once in a while, somebody would come up and just ask for a picture, but that was it. I mean, maybe once a week, and I definitely got what I was, going there for. I worked hard. I mean, I took most students in a quarter take about 18 to 20 credits units. I took 62 units my last quarter. So I knew what I wanted. There were professors I wanted to work with, and I worked with them. And I knew that I was going to get as much out of it as I put in, and that's what I did. And at Tisch. And I'm at Columbia as well. It's just, if I go there and show that I'm serious about it and I'm not there for any other reason, then there are stuff there that I want to learn and there are people there that I want to work with. And if I go and show that, then, I get great results.
What was the directing experience like for you two on, was it Red Leaves?
We were going to make Red Leaves. We were really down the road. It was supposed to be a short, it's based on a Faulkner short story. And, it's like 1830s. There's a great set piece, like this old steamboat that's washed up on the river and the Native Americans are living in it. And everybody's telling me, you should make it into a feature. And I just wanted to, maintain the integrity of the short story. It was just so kind of tightly written and great builds and everything. And I just wanted to make it as a short, but it was ultimately I was going to be paying for it. And nobody wants to pay for a short, especially not that expensive of a short. And so I just decided to put that one on the back burner. But what it did do is it opened me up to other classic American short stories that will not require the same kind of set pieces and everything. So, because I like the idea of short films, maybe to make it a little bit more commercial, I like the idea of intertwining short films. So, it certainly opened me to that idea, and probably one of the projects I'll be doing at Tisch.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks
everyone.
Nice
work. Turn down the dial. I don't want another listening to something I've had enough of. It's all the same, a big misconception. Thinking I'd find what I was looking for. Love is not just a fix anymore. Man needs to feel something more. So maybe it's time that I tear down the walls, open my eyes. I wanna know love in another life. There's gotta be more to this life. Let me know love in another life. Fed from the ruin of manic pursuits that left nothing to gain. In desolate bars, drowning in whiskey, in back rooms with boys that don't have a name. At some point we all want the same, to live and let go of the pain. ocean. So maybe it's time that I tear down the walls, open my eyes. I want another love and another life. There's gotta be more to this life. Let me know love and another life. Oh, I want another love and another life. There's gotta be more to this life. Turn down the time. I don't want another.
Levi Kreis, Love in Another Light, from his album One of the Ones. This is Queer Voices.
Well, I'm sorry if some of that audio wasn't as hearable as we would like to have it have been, but that was supplied to us, and I thought it was pretty good, some of the interview parts of that about the film Melk. It's playing currently exclusively here in Houston at the River Oaks Theater, and I know we've been talking about it a lot, but it is really, really a good movie to see because not only the subject matter, but how well it has been done.
Absolutely, especially the acting. And if you look at the end of the movie, they show the actual people versus the actors.
Yes,
and it's amazing.
How? Yes, exactly. And how they it is the time period. How much it has changed in the way people dressed and acted. And
I just love how they recreate San Francisco in the 70s in the movie, and it's just like flashing back.
And I understand that the opening scenes where you show people being pulled out of bars and thrown into paddy wagons to be taken down to jail, which was the norm back then, that was actual footage. I wasn't sure whether that was recreated or not.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah. Now that you say that, it seemed like it was actual footage. But, I mean, I like just Sean Penn's performance. I think, if anything, that Academy Award, hopefully.
No. Sean Penn was fabulous in that, and I give him credit for doing movies like that.
Well, it's hard to do a big old gay role when you're this kind of macho actor, you know, to step out of your kind of normal roles.
Well, I think Brokeback Mountain probably sort of helped break that mold where straight actors didn't have a problem playing gay actors, because that used to be considered the kiss of death.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm sorry, I just forget his name right now, in Torch Song Trilogy, Matthew Broderick.
Right, right.
He was warned not to play, first of all, on Broadway, and then later in the movie, to play the gay character. First of all, he was playing he played the young, mm-hmm. the adopted son, and then he played the second lover in the movie because he was older at that time. But it didn't hurt his career. Anyway, we'd like to thank you for joining us this week, and we have some good surprises coming up in the next week or so of Queer Voices, including a Christmas special on December 22nd by J.D. Doyle of Queer Christmas Music.
And today is World AIDS Day, so please observe World AIDS Day. There's a lot of events coming on this week. WorldAIDSDayHouston.org for more information on that.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Have you been partying like a holiday rock star? Making the scene at the office party, the neighborhood progressive dinner, your friend's party, your party with your girlfriend? Do you need something to relieve the party pain? Then ask yourself, can you pass the S&S test? The test occurs Saturday, December 20th, Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, 1031 East 24th Street, just off North Main and south of the North Loop. The S&S test is a Jerry Christmas 2, a celebration of the music of the Grateful Dead, Garcia, and Inspired Jams. The S&S test is a 90.1 KPFT Houston benefit concert, the cure for other holiday parties. Music will be provided by Plump, the Hightailers, Guy Schwartz, Star Jernigan, Third Ear, the Psychedelos, and many others. Nonstop relief begins at 5 p.m. The door fee is a donation to the station.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.